The first mass-produced plug-in electric cars sold in the United States are set to hit auto showrooms by the end of this year. The Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt already have tens of thousands of pre-orders, so this type of car appears to be ready to move beyond the domain of tech hobbyists and environmentalists. Still, there are plenty of questions about their feasibility. Here's Andrea Kissick of member station KQED in San Francisco.
I have never been into cars. I don't know an oil filter from an air filter. But my 15-year-old Honda is on its last legs, and recently I've been curious about alternative fuels. So, with electric cars around the corner, my dream of green motoring suddenly seems possible.
Okay, already it looks different.
I spent some time behind the wheel of a shiny new, powder blue, all-electric Nissan Leaf, an aerodynamic four-door hatchback with a range of 100 miles. Paul Haasen from Nissan joins me for a test drive outside the San Francisco Giants ballpark.
You're going to want to turn on the car by stepping on the brake.
It's roomy.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised because I'm like almost 5'10", and oftentimes in these small cars, I'm not comfortable.
You'll find that the rear seat is equally as roomy.
As Haasen launches into car salesman speak, I search for the brake.
This is the brake, the big
yes,
one.
Yes, yes.
And this is the gas pedal.
Yes.
Oh, wait, you don't call it the gas pedal. What would you call it? The power?
It'd be an accelerator pedal.
The dashboard overwhelms me with a confusing array of digital displays. There's some kind of interactive bar graph that I think is supposed to tell me when I'm about to run out of juice. And a satellite map of charging stations I can use. Not very many of them at this point. More on that later. After several attempts to start the car...
Whoops, I hit it twice. That was too fast. Push it in, push my brake on.
You have to
I'm already can't even get this.
You have to depress the brake.
I finally managed to start the car, and much like hybrids, I can't really hear anything. As we drive up over the Bay Bridge toward Berkeley, I notice a blind spot because of the small back window. Otherwise, I find my excitement building as the car zooms along.
So one of the things is this car goes fast. I mean, when you were talking, I noticed I was 72 miles an hour. I didn't even know it.
Yep.
I mean, wow.
Top speed is 90 miles per hour.
I could get a ticket in this car. It's a wild feeling driving without a tailpipe. The downside, instead of a gas tank, which might run an average of 300 miles, a big lithium-ion battery pack sits under the car. One charge only lasts for about 100 miles. I need to figure out how to get around with this kind of limited range. So I check in with car guru Carl Brower, an editor at Edmunds.com.
You have to probably have a secondary vehicle that you know is a backup that you can utilize.
What? I need to buy two cars? Isn't there something else I can do?
What people need to do is get better about planning and not assuming that they can just go out and run four different errands coming back and forth each time.
I'm also going to have to think about how I use my radio, heater, wipers. They can all run a battery down pretty quickly. And that's where the competition thinks it has an advantage. GM's new midsize Chevy Volt is a hybrid, yes, but a new type of hybrid, a plug-in. It will go 40 miles on pure battery power, but then, when that juice runs out, it can go another 300 miles on gas power. GM couldn't make a Volt available for me to test drive, but at a little more than $33,000 after federal tax credits, the car is just too expensive for me. I asked GM's Shad Balk, why the high price tag?
I don't believe the Volt is so expensive. I mean, it's an electric car that can be your only car. So the value that you get out of this car is a pretty good deal.
But Nissan's all-electric Leaf is just $20,000 after state and federal tax credits. That's just more affordable. And it would get me one of California's coveted carpool stickers for low-emission vehicles. But one thing still haunts me, that fancy satellite map on the Nissan Leaf dashboard, showing less than a handful of charging stations out there. I don't want to run out of juice and be stranded by the side of the road. Even driving solo in the Diamond Lane isn't worth that. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Kissick.
And tomorrow, Andrea goes in search of a battery charge. The social networking site Facebook has been dogged by privacy concerns almost since it was founded in a Harvard dorm room. Now the company has a new approach to protect users' privacy, as NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Critics have accused Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg of not caring about privacy, and in the past, he's made remarks that indicated that he did not. But at a press conference, Zuckerberg said it was a core part of their belief that people own and control all of their information on Facebook. The new features he announced will let people easily make small groups that are closed to outsiders. So, if you want to have conversations with your family and aren't keen on sharing it all with your coworkers, you can make a family group. There will also be what Zuckerberg called a dashboard that lets you see exactly what kind of information certain games and outside applications are taking from your page. Say you play a game and it gets access to your contacts. Now you can block that aspect of the game. Lastly, users will be able to download their entire profile to their computers. Photos, updates, comments. And if you leave Facebook, you can take it with you. Speaking after the press conference, Forrester Research analyst Ray Augie said the company made great strides in fixing privacy problems.
There's always going to be some level of criticism, but no, I think that this is a really smart step for Facebook. And I think all three things they announced here today helps move the ball forward in terms of greater control and greater transparency.
The new features will begin rolling out immediately. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Earlier this week, Verizon agreed to refund about $50 million to customers. The company was improperly charging them for data services, things like browsing the web, checking email, and using apps. We ask you, our listeners, if you've had similar experiences, and we were deluged with responses. Emily Snow is a Verizon customer from Roy, Utah.
We started getting a lot of $1.99 charges. And 1 month we had four of them, so that was about $8 on our account. And it was because the button that turned on the internet was one that was really easy to hit.
In Kingsville, Texas, Stephen Parrott opened his Verizon bill one day and found over $200 worth of data charges.
We pay for a data package that's unlimited. And when I noticed that they were charging us per megabyte, that's when I kind of flipped out and gave them a call and complained.
Stories from our listeners, and now let's hear from Parul Desai. She's a lawyer with the Consumers Union, which publishes Consumer Reports. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, over 800 of our listeners responded with stories. So how common is this that people are getting blindsided by charges for using data on their phones?
Well, I think this is increasingly becoming a problem. And in fact, according to a recent survey by the Federal Communications Commission, some 30 million Americans have experienced cellular phone bill shock, which is a surprise spike unrelated to a change in their service plan. And according to that survey, more than a third of the group that they talked to got hit with at least a $50 a month overage charge. And we think the usual overcharges actually might be higher.
Let's talk about data. Unlike minutes, which are pretty easy to track, how hard is it to track how much data you're using on your phone?
This industry has no oversight and there's no responsibility. So, you know, some carriers may provide you with a tracking system. They may notify you. But most people don't understand how much 50 megabytes is or 2 kilobits is. And so I think it's hard for cell phone users to really understand how much data they're using. And if they're not being alerted that they're about to go over, I think it is becoming increasingly a common problem, as you see with these high overage charges.
The FCC next week will release proposed rules to address this problem. What are some of the ideas out there?
I expect that the FCC will consider what alerts or notifications should be provided to customers who are about to incur either roaming charges or who are about to exceed their voice, text, or data limits. I would also expect and hope that the FCC would propose notifying consumers of the various overcharges that they may incur if they're about to go over, and the carrier would seek consent for those overage charges.
And how is the industry responding to generally these issues?
I think generally the industry is suggesting that no standardized rules are necessary, that voluntary commitments and guidelines will suffice for the future. And like I said, some carriers have started to provide notice like AT&T and U.S. Cellular, but without any firm guidelines, it's confusing to consumers to even understand from carrier to carrier what those overcharges are, or even to compare, since there is no standardized or consistent formats.
So for the moment, consumers are left with watch your bill.
Correct. Right now, it's important for consumers to be vigilant about watching their bill, looking at the fees that are being charged, and calling their carriers if they have any questions about their charges. And as we saw in the Verizon case, if they're unhappy with the response that they're getting, to also inform the FCC of the issues that they're having.
Parul Desai is a lawyer with the Consumers Union, which puts out consumer reports. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Social media is often thought of as the brave new world, but often it looks just like the old world. A conference kicking off in Miami, Florida this weekend aims to change that. It's the second annual Blogalicious Weekend. Hundreds of blogging professionals and writers will share tips, as well as enjoy morning yoga and evening social events. We wanted to know more about the conference, so we're joined by one of the founders, Nadia Jones. She's part of the Mama Law Media Group, which aims to increase online representation, particularly among women of color. She joins us from NPR member station WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida. We're also joined by Anna White. She's one of the featured speakers at the conference, and she has her own blog about furniture making. And she joins us from NPR member station KSKA in Anchorage, Alaska. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you so much for having me as well.
Well, we're excited to have you. So Nadia, tell us, what inspired you to organize this conference?
Myself and my two other founders have been blogging at mamalaw.com and started attending various marketing events and conferences. And we noticed that there was a lack of diversity in some of the activities that we were participating in. So we decided to do something about that and knew that women of color and multicultural women have a voice in social media. And we wanted our voice to be heard. So we founded Blogalicious Weekend Conferences.
Anna, tell us about your blog.
My blog is basically about building furniture from off-the-shelf lumber. I've been blogging for about 11 months now, and just overnight, the reception has been incredible. And I really feel like I'm in the position I'm in because I am a minority, because there hasn't been much of a voice for minority women bloggers.
Tell us a little bit more about your background.
My mother actually was born and raised in Vietnam. She never learned to read or write. She cannot drive. And she is legally blind.
Wow.
But it is this that has taught me to be resourceful and industrious. And it gave me a unique voice online.
Nadia, what do you get from blogging? What do you like about blogging?
I like the encouragement and the support that I get on our personal blog. We just really write about some of the struggles that we're facing as working moms. The three of us are attorneys. And it's really a form of cheap therapy, actually. It's like writing in a journal, but putting it online and having the ability to get other people to kind of respond to your reactions and your experiences that you're going through.
We've talked about this some on this program. This has also been discussed a bit. Part of the gender imbalance online, some people think, is the tone that online conversations seem to take very often. This kind of heckler's veto, it's the kind of so's your mom attitude. You know, a lot of the people who are drawn to it are drawn to it for the purpose of being mean. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you have had that experience, and why do you think that is?
No, I have not had that sort of experience. My experiences have been nothing but positive. I have heard of some unfortunate experiences where people may have been heckled for their decision to do something with their children or in their personal lives. And I just try to stay away from that because that's not why I wanted to blog. I wanted to blog, like I said, for the encouragement and the support of other women who are going through the same struggles that I am.
Anna, what about you? Have you ever had any kind of negative feedback on your blog? Or maybe you just screen everything?
To be real honest with you, I've had over 10,000 positive comments on my blog, and I've maybe had three negative ones. But those negative ones were more hurtful and powerful than 10,000 positive ones. And that's really sad.
Why do you think that is?
I don't have the exact answer, because you would think 10,000 positive comments would be so much more powerful than a few negative ones. But I think that, you know, when somebody is really critical, they tend to be really harsh, and they know where it's going to hurt, so they pick that bone. And I think sometimes women have a hard time taking a compliment, if you know what I mean.
Well, there are. I've heard it said the other way. Gloria Steinem says that women are sort of socialized to be more receptive to criticism than to praise.
Yes.
So that's sort of one theory. But the kinds of negative comments that you've gotten, have they been personal attacks? What?
Yes. And, you know, I've heard it all. I've heard, you know, she's had work done, she's fat, she's thin. And you just really have to focus in on those 10,000 positive comments.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about Blogalicious Weekend. It's a conference that aims to promote diversity in social media. It kicks off tomorrow. Our guests are bloggers Anna White and Nadia Jones. Nadia, what about you? Why do you think it is that there still is this gender imbalance and not quite the level of representation from people of color that you would like to see? Although it is interesting to say that, you know, there have been a number of surveys done recently, we've reported on them, that say that young people of color are in many ways more likely to be involved in social media than others. So why do you think this imbalance still exists?
You're exactly right. The imbalance is actually not there. It's the perception that marketers have. They don't think that we have the numbers that maybe some of your mainstream bloggers would have. But we are using our smartphones. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We have blogs. We have a voice. And we have readership. And what we've done through Blogalicious Weekend is we've tried to show marketers that we are here and that we are influential in the market space.
So, Anna, what's your message going to be at the conference?
Definitely that your passion is your product. Who you are is what you blog about. And then your blog is simply a means of getting that message out.
And do I understand that you live in a kind of a remote area? Is that true?
I do.
Area? So you even had to fly to get to the studio today.
Well, we couldn't get a flight, so we ended up driving 7 hours, and it's actually snowing on the way up here in Alaska, but I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we appreciate your effort
to talk
to us, but I'm wondering if that's in part what blogging does. It kind of connects you to other worlds in a way that would be harder to do otherwise.
Absolutely. You know, I am just this housewife that had long ago given up on any aspirations of having a career. And I just started writing a blog because I felt like it would, you know, give me just an avenue to share my talent. And I would never, ever dream it would become what it has. And I think that my story shows what a huge opportunity there exists for bloggers.
Now, if we get together 10 years from now, do you think you'll still have a need for a Blogalicious Weekend, or do you think it'll be different, or what do you think?
Well, if I had a crystal ball, definitely. I think there will always be a need for Blogalicious Weekend, only because women of color, we're not going anywhere. This is a multicultural world where we live in, and even though we may be discussing different platforms or different ways in which we blog or get our message out and gather our community, we're still going to have a community, and we're still going to want to get together and support each other, empower each other, and encourage each other. So I'm excited about what the future has for us.
Nadia Jones is one of the founders of Blogalicious Weekend. She joined us from NPR member station WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida. Also with us, Anna White. She is one of the event speakers. She's also the author of a blog about furniture making, and she joined us from member station KSKA in Anchorage, Alaska. I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
And blog it out.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week, and we have special treat this week, right, Flora?
It is a special treat. I think this is the kind of treat that Science Friday listeners have probably been waiting for a long time. The pick of the week this week is you, Ira. You are the
drawn
pick of
and
the
quartered.
Week. So we went out.
We went on the roads of New York.
We went on the roads of New York in Nissan's new plug-in electric vehicle, the Leaf.
The Leaf. And this is not a hybrid. This is totally plug-in.
100% electric. And you drove.
I drove it.
So if you want to get in the passenger seat, if you've been sort of, you know, you listened to Ira in the car all these years, and now you can actually be in the car with Ira.
Yeah. Flora took our cameras out onto the streets of New York, drove around Central Park, up and around, and in the Nissan Leaf, and I own a Prius, everybody knows that, and I tried to compare it.
Yeah, so
that.
What did you think, actually?
I thought it was quite nice. I mean, it handled very well, it was quiet, and if you want to see that, our little trip around, you can go to sciencefriday.com where your video is up there.
So how did the acceleration feel to you? I think people are sort of worried that electric cars aren't going to be as powerful, or maybe they won't feel as sturdy.
You know, electric motors accelerate, I think, faster than gasoline engines.
Really?
You step on, I've even said it in the video, I made the mistake of saying I step on the gas. Well, there is no gas.
Yeah, it's true, though. There's going to have to be a switch, right?
We have to find a different word. I step on the pedal. Step on the electrons, and there's immediate acceleration. You know, we who use subways and live on subways, we always feel that, you know, whoa, it's moving very quickly, immediately. That's what happens. But this is very smooth. It's very sturdy, and I thought it was, you know, a great ride.
And the quietness was really noticeable. It's funny, you know, doing video every week, I hear the background noise, and in this car, you heard nothing. You turned on the car, and you couldn't hear any difference.
No, the car, you know, the car is sitting there, and you say, well, turn it on, and it you push the button. It's on.
You just can't hear that.
Can't hear it. And people were worried. I know that people you talk to saying, well, should they put an artificial engine sound in it? So on the streets, people will hear you coming. Well, you know, in New York, it doesn't matter how much noise you would put in that car.
You know, it would be very loud to be heard over everything else.
Yeah, but what's interesting is you know, you, as you show in the video, there are plugs. You just plug it in, and it charges. It could charge rapidly or overnight.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I thought was really interesting about the car is showing the sort. It's really like an outlet just right in the front of the grill, and they're the two sizes, and one is the, I think it's 240 volts. It's like your electric dryer is mm-hmm. what Mark Perry, who's the product manager, described it as. And it charges up really fast, 80% of the charge in 30 minutes if you have this sort of special.
That special charger, and for people who are going to have these, and I know there are 30 of them, he was telling me, that are running around in test phases, you could have a special built into your garage, a special rapid charger. And, you know, of course, since it gets 100 miles on the charge, most people are not going to need to come home and recharge it during the day.
Well, this is an interesting thing. I was looking on the Leaf materials, and it sounds like depending on, and we saw this too driving, depending on the climate control and that kind mm-hmm. of stuff, you can get only 60 miles, you know, depending on the conditions.
If it's cold outside, you need that heater.
Right.
If it's hot, you need the air conditioner.
Right.
Now, this may sound like a commercial for the Leaf. It's not. You know, we want to drive all the plug-ins when they come in.
Yeah.
I know that China has one. And this one is not available immediately, is it? We have to wait.
No, you have to wait. You have to have, first of all, I think there are no new reservations for this car. So even if you fell in love with it, mm-hmm. it would be hard to get it. And I think deliveries begin in December. So it's not even actually on the roads yet.
And it's over $30,000 for the car, but you get an incredible tax break on this and a refund, right?
Yeah, and there was actually an article in Today's Times just about all of these refunds you get.
If you get the refund for like $7,500, and if you have a state tax, that gets canceled, the tax. So you can get almost $10,000 return on the car. And I'm just hoping it opens up the new era of plug-ins, because we'd all like to have more plug-ins, I think. And I'd love to take some more rides in them. So.
And I think we'd like to make more videos of it. So one special shout-out, because this video, you know, the real treat of this video is some music that was put together by John Boswell of the Symphony of Science. And you may be one of the millions of people who've seen his handiwork in the Carl Sagan auto-tune video.
And that's how we'll go out today.
We got some overhead lifters and four barrel quads. Oh yeah,
that's
yeah.
me. Is that me?
That's you.
I'll read the credits over it. Our program is produced by senior producer Annette Heist, producer Christopher Taliata, Spanish language producer Lesha Bayak, our science and arts producer Catherine Wells. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Flora is our multimedia editor. Our intern is Anna Rothschild, who also worked the camera in the car today.
Very good job this weekend.
Go, Anna. And Neil Rausch, our technical director. Manola Weatherall sitting in the co-pilot seat today. I'm Ira Flatto in New York. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Let's say you're running for office and you want to smear your opponent. Where can you or one of your supporters go to spread a nasty rumor? Well, could be the radio, could be TV. But what about the new social communities like Twitter? Twitter seems to be the new frontier in political campaigning and the perfect place to launch a campaign of misinformation that can move through cyberspace and into the minds of voters at warp speed before they even know what the other side might be saying. So as a voter, how can you tell if the information you're getting from Twitter is legit or something that may have been posted to deliberately mislead you. You need a truthy tracker. Researchers at Indiana University in Bloomington have come up with a way to track Twitter feeds and sniff out those tweets that might be lies. And to demonstrate how this works, they've agreed to track our tweets on Science Friday. If you follow us on Twitter at SciFriat, S-C-I-F-R-I, retweet the post Truthy at Indiana. Truthy at Indiana. Retweet that and take part in our experiment to see how far and wide a tweet can spread. You can go to our website at sciencefriday.com and also do it that way. And you can see the results of the map that's being created tracing all your tweets. And we'll talk about that now with Johan Bolin. He is associate professor in the School of Informatics and Computing at the Center for Complex Networks and Systems Research at Indiana University in Bloomington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hi, Ira. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you. What was the genesis of this idea?
Well, I think all of us have been noticing that the political debate and the political discourse in the United States over the past, I'll say, 5 or 6 years has become very polarized, very partisan. And one of my colleagues, Filippo Mengser, actually came up with the idea for this website, read a newspaper article about how a group of people at the in Massachusetts tried to actually change the outcome of the election by creating a so-called Twitter bomb, where they set up a bunch of accounts and sent out thousands of tweets on the morning of the election, right, hoping that it would be retweeted and generate enough traffic so it would be picked up on Google. And the tweet in question actually contained a URL that pointed to a web page, as I understand it, that looked like a real news article, but actually contained a false news story. And, of course, we don't know whether that affected the outcome of the election, but it could very well have done that, mm-hmm. or at least have been a factor. So when we heard about that and we put that together with sort of our discomfort about some of the material that we've seen distributed online, like most other people recently, we figured to provide some kind of an antidote to that development.
Well, how can you tell the truthiness? I mean, our hats off to Stephen Colbert for that word. How can you tell the truthiness of a tweet? Now, we have a tweet going on our website, and it looks like, to me, I'll describe it, it looks like the head of the head of a dandelion seed, you know, with all those lollipops coming out of it and with a center in it that we started out as the tweet we want people to retweet. How do you know if that's a real tweet or if it's some campaign smear?
Well, you don't actually know because it's really difficult to make an objective decision on whether something is actually true or false. But you can definitely look at the pattern of how this particular meme spread through the Twitter network. I mean, you see one big central node right in the middle of that dandelion that you mentioned, and then a whole bunch of other nodes that have retweeted that same tweet. So these are users that are essentially following marching orders. And the particular structure of the graph and its evolution over time is actually an indication that something may be going on there that is not entirely natural. And in this case, of course, we know there isn't because we've actually started this.
Because it has a central spot and everything's branching out from the middle, that's an unnatural look.
Well, I wouldn't say it's an unnatural look, but it's one of the many factors that you could look at in terms of how a particular tweet gets started and how it is distributed. I mean, there's a number of factors that we're trying to look at in this architecture. You know, among other things, the number of tweets per user, the sentiment that the content of that tweet contains. So we're looking at a whole bunch of different factors, and in the future, we're hoping that we can actually automate. Set up automated methods that can look at all of these different features and then provide some kind of an assessment of how truthy that particular mean is.
And are you thinking of setting up a site that will evaluate some of these tweets and say, be aware, potential?
Yeah, and I think that's more or less the intention of this project. At this point, we've only just started to collect the data and to design our methods. But we're hoping that in the future this could lead to a sort of a generalizable method, not just for the upcoming elections, but for a number of other applications where we would be able to track these memes, look at their features, look at their how they're being communicated online, who actually started it, where it came from, look at synchronization, apply epidemiological models to how these tweets spread, and try to sort of tweak. A signal from all of these different features and try to determine whether, there's something really suspicious is
right.
going on.
Give me an example of how, if I were to start, what I would do and the mechanism and my objectivity here.
Oh, if you wanted to start a truthy
media... If I wanted to deliberately spread misinformation, what would I be doing?
Well, well, perhaps I shouldn't be telling you. but it, I would say that you would probably have a group of people. You would agree to set up a Twitter account under some false pretense. Mm-hmm. You would design, you would craft a particular tweet to have a particular salient emotional content, something that people would like to pass along that looks kind of true but perhaps isn't. And then you could start to coordinate spreading that meme and sending it to your followers and so on. You know, it's really as simple as that. You know, since we don't have a very precise machine definition of what it means to be for a meme to be truthy, it's really difficult to tell you, you know, how to best do that. Mm. But the fact is that people are doing this. There's no doubt that both political parties or any political groups are actually using Twitter deliberately to spread misleading and deceiving information.
So. And one other interesting part of this is that you mentioned at the beginning that once this starts to spread, it makes its way into the Google search engine.
Yeah.
And that adds another layer to it.
That adds a really interesting feedback loop, because once it generates enough activity and it's actually listed at the top of those search results, then people may actually click on that tweet and may start to retweet it themselves. And that generates more traffic, and it increases the ranking of that that tweet on Google. And so you've got a really nice positive feedback loop where, from very humble beginnings, so to speak, you can launch a meme into the public consciousness and have it propagate. So it's really a little bit like studying flu epidemics. Huh. And one member of our team is one of the world's leading experts in how diseases actually spread from person to person, and the process in which these tweets spread from person to person may be modeled along the same lines.
Is there anything illegal about doing this?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's really difficult to... Well, let me put it this way. I think there's laws on slander and so on that would stop you from posting things that are, you know, illegal or hate speech. But I think it's perfectly viable to come up with something that is truthy, you know, just truthy enough to not be illegal, and to make it popular enough to affect political outcomes.
Mm-hmm. And so are you going to be watching for this election cycle?
Yes, we're very much hoping to do that, and hopefully we can continue this effort past the elections, because there will be more elections, and there will be more events where it will be necessary to monitor the truthiness of the memes that are circulating on Twitter. In fact, we're fully anticipating releasing our data and our software to the public, so mm-hmm. other people can actually build on top of what we've done.
Well, we have a video up on our website at sciencefriday.com of this retweet that we started. And if you want to go look at it, go to sciencefriday.com and watch it spread. And watch the retweets happen and get a sort of a demonstration of what you're talking about. And I understand you're going to be updating it for us as we go along.
Yes, yes, because apparently that network is still evolving. And, you know, on our website, we actually showed the amount of activity over time that a particular meme receives. And you can actually really see that there's a first wave where that tweet was actually launched. And we can see sort of a spike in activity with regards to that meme. And then a second spike of activity that seems to correspond to the network developing additional branches and so on. So it's a really nice... it's a really nice animation.
Mm-hmm. And how soon will you have other of these up there? If you find something suspicious, will you be posting things yourself as the weeks go on?
Well, the website automatically updates. So whenever a meme achieves a certain level of activity, we catch that and we update the website to include that meme. So it's constantly refreshing in real time, and you know, if anyone launches a truthy meme that gets enough traction, we'll be able to find it in our data.
You know, this is always sort of a spy versus spy world. Do you think people are now looking already at your truthy ideas and saying, gee, how do we get around this thing?
Yeah, I bet they are. You know, that wouldn't surprise me, but at the same time, hopefully we've increased the cost of doing these things just enough to make it a little less likely.
You mean the real, the physical or mental, or is it actually monetary cost?
Well, I wouldn't say monetary cost, but, you know, if right now it's really easy to set up, you know, 10 Twitter accounts and start spreading these memes and hoping they go viral and they get a lot of traction. But it may very well be that in the future when people actually catch those kind of patterns, like the dandelion that we're seeing with the meme that we created and that we launched deliberately, you know, once people notice that that's one of the features we're looking at, they may have to involve a lot more people in spreading these kind of memes.
Is there any second generation or third generation to this? Or are you thinking ahead or are you just trying to get this stage settled?
Yes. Well, we're first trying to get this stage settled. So we're definitely looking at all of the different features. Actually, users can go to the website right now and, for example, report whether they think a meme is particularly truthy. There's a whole bunch of other features like the number of users per tweet, the growth of the meme and so on. And we're definitely looking to generate automated methods that would allow us to look at all of these different features and then provide some kind of an assessment of the truthiness of a meme. Yeah.
Well, if you'd like to participate, we'll be going all day, and for the next few days you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can tweet us at SciFry, join our Twitter group, and then retweet Truthy at Indiana and see how well that works. And it's all there on our page at sciencefriday.com. I want to thank you for taking time and for helping us out with this crowdsourcing today.
No, our pleasure entirely.
So it'd be interesting to watch for the weeks and watch the weeks ahead of how it all works out. Thanks again, Johan.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Johan Boland is associate professor in the School of Informatics and Computing at the Center for Complex Networks and System Research at Indiana University in Bloomington.